just to, so he could make it clear that he was just a civilian once again. I think that one story, for me, just sort of powerfully evokes, you know, the idea of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people left behind who would have had to very, very quickly readjust to a different way of life, you know, potentially, with the threat of being, you know, of recrimination if they had, you know, if it was proved that they had been collaborating with the Americans or been in the South Vietnamese army.
And now, all these stories are very well, but I just want to challenge sort of this heroic narrative, of course, that many mainstream documentaries about the Vietnam War puts across, especially particularly in this documentary, Lindsay. What do you think of this heroic narrative? I mean, it's not in a vacuum. Did the US soldiers have any business being in Vietnam anyway?
Well, I would argue they didn't, and I think most people now, in terms of the, you know, the 40 years or so since the final fall of Saigon, would argue the same, that it was not a just war. It was an absolutely brutal war, which went on. The French, first of all, fought it because it was their former colony. Then the United States came in. And if you look at what they did, the use of chemical weapons in the form of Agent Orange, which caused massive environmental and human damage. It's estimated that 2 million Vietnamese died, 58,000 US soldiers died. And the US soldiers, I mean, the thing that's very missing from this, and probably accurately it's missing because by that time the regular soldiers had gone, but the soldiers themselves killed many of their officers. It was the biggest sort of mutiny or mutinous atmosphere that the Americans ever had to deal with in wartime. And of course, many, many soldiers demonstrated when they were back in the States, were involved in the anti-war movement. It was a mass movement. And none of that, of course, comes across. But there was a great sense that this was an injustice. That by the mid-60s, a great sense it was an injustice. And that was reflected not just in the US, in Germany there were huge demos, in Britain, in all of the Western countries, people were very, very much against it.
That was a very powerful point. And Dave, I'd like to pick up on your thoughts on that also in the next part.
When President Ford went before the Congress, he had two major concerns. The first was to save as many people as we could. He cared for the human beings involved. They were not just pawns that once they had lost their military power were abandoned. The second was the honor of America, that we would not be seen at the final agony of South Vietnam as having stabbed it in the back.
Congress wouldn't pass it. They said no more, you know, no more troops, no more money, no more aid to the Vietnamese. Well, I had to go into President Ford's office to tell him.
Now, Dave, I just wanted to pick up on a point that Lindsay made earlier on before we went to the clip. Would you have liked to have seen more political context to this documentary, perhaps to expose more of the crimes in the area?
I would have. I do think it. I mean, I think it's very good on the micro. It's very good on those final days, those final weeks in Saigon. It's not especially good on the wider context of the war, which, as you said at the very beginning, has spanned two decades. It's not particularly great on the immediate political context, which is hinted at by that clip. Either, I mean, it reduces the background politics to a fairly simple Ford was willing to provide more aid to the South Vietnamese. Congress said no. It does. You mentioned heroism before. I mean, it does point the finger of heroism towards Gerald Ford as well there. Mm-hmm. And obviously Kissinger was in his government at the time, so obviously has, you know, a reason to be pushing that narrative as well. But at the same time, the film doesn't set out to offer that context. I think I'd have been a bit more dismayed if it offered the context in a more simplistic way, or in a more narrow-minded or biased way. And I think it prefers to avoid it, and prefers just to put you into the melee of those final days, and it does that well.
Mm-hmm. And Lindsay, following on from that clip, they showed Henry Kissinger, who was in this documentary, and some would accuse him of being a war criminal. How do you think he was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I think he's portrayed very favourably in the documentary, and of course when he says in that clip, you know, we were concerned about human life, I mean, it's a slightly grotesque way to talk about it when you think of how many people had died by the time that he was describing his final evacuation. So I think it's kinder to Kissinger than probably history is or will be to him. I think he played a bad role in all of this. And of course they kept escalating this war. This is what people forget. This is, it's only in these last years that they de-escalated, and even in 75 they're talking about more money going to prop up what was a puppet government in South Vietnam. You know, I think it's quite unsatisfactory at that level, but perhaps not surprising as well. Once you've got Henry Kissinger to interview, which is quite a coup, then you're not going to ask him any challenging questions, probably.
Mm. And would you agree with that, Dave?
I would. I mean, it would have been interesting to know. I mean, going back to that particular clip there, and again, the film doesn't really set out to offer this context, but it would have been interesting to know more about the reason why Congress was so opposed to offering more aid at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, presumably partly because in the Vietnam War for the American people had become a massive millstone around the American people's neck, and it was just something that they really wished to put behind them, you know, for many, many valid reasons. But the film doesn't explore that. It leaves those questions begging if you don't bring a lot of knowledge to the film.
Actually, Lindsay, I think that relates to you. I mean, as someone who was inspired into political activism by the Vietnam War, what was the anti-war movement like at that time, and do you think this was affecting Congress's decision?
Well, no. Funnily enough, by the time this was happening, the anti-war movement was much weaker than it had been in the late 60s and early 70s, partly because most of the troops had gone. People could see that it was coming to an end. But there was very, very big sentiment against the war, and there was and also the point that Dave makes is right, I think, about the politically people were, it was an absolute millstone around their necks. But also by the mid 70s, the world economy had turned towards very serious recession after decades of boom. Mm-hmm. So of course the Americans were also thinking that we can't really afford this, and it's usually accepted that the Vietnam War was a big driver of inflation in the 60s and early 70s, which led to some of this economic crisis. So I think they just thought, you know, let's get out of here. We've, as the Americans quite often do, we've seen this before and since.
It's a very interesting discussion so far, but we'll just have to pause for now.
Thought of my friends who were killed in action, and I thought, well, is this what we fought for? Is this what the Americans came for? And I didn't have the answer.
I have wrestled with this ever since. I realized that I had become the quintessential American in Vietnam. I had all these causes, all these big things I was doing. I was trying to get the truth back to Washington. I was talking to agents, trying to persuade the ambassador. And I forgot that what was at stake were human lives.
For years after that, I hear that sound in my head, that sound like ch-ch-ch-ch. In the middle of the night, to jump up, I thought the helicopter come pick me up. I called it Dream in the Wind.
That was absolutely devastating war. Now, Dave, one of the criticisms you can make of this documentary is that the number of people who have died, the casualties from the war, is missing. I mean, it's not until 1995 did Vietnam release its official estimate of the death toll, as many as 2 million civilians on both sides and some 1.1 million North Vietnamese and Viet Cong fighters, whereas the U.S. military actually say that between 200,000 and 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers died, so it's a fraction compared to the Vietnamese statistics. Do you think this is a weakness of the documentary also? Would you have liked to have seen this more?
I think the film struggles slightly actually to know how to end and how to conclude, because it doesn't do that. It doesn't wrap up with a summary of, because these events are the final events of the Vietnam War. It could very naturally then have a, you know, conclusion which wraps up the entire history of a two decade conflict, but it doesn't do that. And I think I pretty welcome the fact it doesn't, because it would turn it into something else. I mean, it does. It does. Deal with high-level politics at some points. You know, it deals with decisions that have to be made by U.S. generals and the U.S. ambassador in Saigon, but it does try to bring it back to the experience of more ground level, you know, people on both sides, mm-hmm. you know, or Americans and South Vietnamese, wherever it can. I think if it just gave us a load of figures and statistics at the end, it would be a little bit unfaithful to the film it has been before, really. So I think it tries to end on, as we see there, on a more human, a more sorrowful note, mm. And I think it tries to give a sense of, you know, the futility of war generally on the human level. I'm not sure it does that entirely powerfully. I'm not sure it does that as powerfully as it achieves other things throughout the film. But I think I welcome it trying to end on that note,
mm. which is fair enough, I suppose. And Lindsay, I mean, the U.S. lost at least 58,000 troops, mm. and I've read in my research that this is still a controversial issue as to the U.S. narrative is that. They didn't win the war, they didn't lose the war. Why is this such a still controversial issue?
I think it's a very big question still in America. I mean, obviously, the surviving veterans and the surviving anti-war protesters come to that are now older. You know, they're now quite old. They're people who are sort of pensioner age and so on. It's still a very contested thing. There's still a very contested thing. Was it justified? There's still many, many veterans who are disabled and who are mentally and physically ill as a result of the war. And of course America doesn't like losing wars. I mean, this is Trump's election. You know, he says we don't mind going to war, but we want to be able to win those wars. And of course Vietnam showed them they couldn't win the wars despite this huge superior air power and military might in general, despite targeting quite deliberately civilians, which they did, yeah. Who they claimed were sort of hiding the Viet Cong and the people who were fighting. Despite all this, they lost, and they lost because of what the Vietnamese people themselves did. They lost because their own soldiers didn't have the faith in it that perhaps they might have done in previous wars. And they lost because the people at home said, look, we don't want this either. So I think it's still a very big issue in American politics. And, of course, you know, it's contemporary in the sense that there was what was called the Vietnam Syndrome, which did stop these interventions for the best part of 20 years. Mm. And now we're back with a vengeance with all of those.
Well, it's really great to see how it relates to today as well. And I'm afraid we'll have to leave the discussion here. I wish we could talk longer. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on May 7th, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the International Al-Quds Day. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, in his speech on the occasion of International Quds Day, referring to the change in the balance of power in favor of Islamic world and Palestine, emphasized, "I tell you with confidence the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and will not stop."
I tell you with confidence, these attempts will not get them anywhere. The downward movement of the Zionist enemy has started, and it will not stop moving downward. The decisive factors in the future, the continued activities of the resistance in the occupied lands and Muslims, support for the Palestinian Mujahids. There are two determining factors in the future. First and foremost is the continued activities of resistance in the Palestinian lands and the strengthening of the line of jihad and martyrdom, and second, global support on the part of governments and Muslim nations throughout the world for the Palestinian Mujahids. All of us, government officials, intellectuals, religious scholars, political parties and groups, the brave youths and people of various social backgrounds, should determine our position in this public movement and play our part.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
This is what nullifies the enemy's plots, and it will be an apocalyptic manifestation of this Quranic verse. Or do they intend a plot? But those who defy Allah are themselves involved in a plot. The Holy Quran, chapter 52, verse 42. And Allah has full power and control over His affairs, but most among mankind do not know. The Holy Quran, chapter 12, verse 21.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
debate.
The Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip has continued, claiming civilian casualties while destroying vital buildings and infrastructure in the Gaza Strip. In this edition of the debate, we will look at whether the Israeli bombing constitutes war crimes or not. We'll also look at how the world condemnation against Israel has reached a level that it may lead it to the unraveling of Israel itself. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate is Kevin Barrett. He's an author and Middle East expert who joins us from Madison. We also have Daniel Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who joins us from Pittsburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. And Kevin Barrett, let me first start with you. Israel's bombing of the Gaza Strip has destroyed vital infrastructure, including medical facilities, media outlets, and electricity infrastructure. Some of this is required for daily, basically, existence of the Palestinians there in the Gaza Strip. Has Israel committed war crimes?
Absolutely. Israel is the only country that virtually admits to deliberately targeting civilians. That's what they mean when they talk about mowing the lawn every few years and killing a couple thousand more Palestinian civilians. They are utterly shameless in targeting civilian buildings, as the international mainstream media people found out to their chagrin last week when this media building was blown up. Israel claims sometimes that when it's indiscriminately raining down bombs on Gaza, that it's thinking that maybe there are tunnels beneath some of these homes. That's their excuse for just blowing up anybody. But we know from the behavior of the Israeli military in situations like the deliberate sport shooting of children, which is still going on. We just saw more of this in the West Bank just today. A number of children, including a 15-year-old YouTube star, were deliberately murdered by Israeli troops who were a couple of hundred meters away in no danger whatsoever from any rocks or anything. They just killing these kids. Chris Hedges wrote about actually witnessing this many years ago when he was in Palestine. He actually saw the Israeli troops broadcasting out obscene insults on loudspeakers in order to lure Palestinian children out of their homes within range of the guns so the Israeli soldiers could shoot them in the gut for sport. So this is the kind of army we have in Israel, the so-called most moral army in the world, as they call themselves, laughing with duper's delight at the big lies that they spread, as they know very well that they are the most sadistic people in the world who actually enjoy murdering children. So when they bomb Gaza, they're not really thinking that they're going after military targets, and oops, they just happen to kill some civilians or blow up a media building or blow up some ambulances or some hospitals or some United Nations installations and so on. That's what they're doing as a matter of policy, is targeting civilians. That's called terrorism, and Thomas Suarez, in his book State of Terror, exposes how terrorism has been the prime weapon all along in the creation and maintenance of the illegitimate so-called state of Israel.
Okay, well, Daniel Kovalik, what we're seeing unfold right now is pretty much reminiscent of what has occurred in the past wars. At this point, Gaza hospital overwhelmed with the wounded. Gaza city medical workers don't have a certain medical and life-saving medication, for example, to deal with the wounded. And, of course, the number of injured keeps increasing because of the way that the buildings have been destroyed, et cetera. Why hasn't the international community at least provided the humanitarian relief that is quite necessary in order to at least be able to save some of the injured that are flowing into the hospitals, for example?
Well, I think the United States has been a big impediment to any attempts by the United Nations Security Council to address this issue, either with humanitarian aid or with a demand for a ceasefire. Apparently, President Biden has now on three occasions prevented the Security Council from issuing a resolution calling for the Israelis to stop these attacks. Meanwhile, of course, Joe Biden has also approved over $700 billion in emergency assistance for ammunition for the Israelis. That is, apparently the Israelis are running out of ammunition to keep killing people in Gaza, and so Biden's going to make sure they still have that ammunition. So, in short, the answer to your question is the United States. That is the largest impediment to making sure that Israel does the right thing here and that humanitarian aid is provided to the Palestinian people.
Well, Kevin Barrett, I believe that from what our guests there said about the $735 million worth of precision-guided missiles that the U.S. has approved as an emergency, this probably falls under the notion by the U.S. of the right to self-defense, in which, in this case, Israel has that right against the people that it has colonized. You know, we're looking at then grave violations to happen. Is that a green light when you have the right to self-defense to then commit, in some cases, war crimes?
Well, the United States government is complicit in this big lie, among some of the other big lies. They claim that Israel is acting defensively, but that's utterly ridiculous. As we all know, the people who created Israel, who were in fact mostly atheist, ethnically Jewish Zionists who worshipped a kind of collectivist military project to invade the Holy Land, these people were obviously aggressors. They crossed the oceans and the seas to invade somebody else's homeland with the intention of expelling the people who lived there and or murdering them and ethnically cleansing the Holy Land so that they could set up their supremacist state. So that was a quintessential act of aggression. In all of the history of military aggression, there's really never been a more clear-cut case than the Zionist aggression that colonized and ethnically cleansed Palestine. So the problem is that the Zionists themselves are the world's leading experts on being perpetrators and oppressors and pretending to be victims. Just like bullies on schoolyards will grab their victims' little hands and slap their own faces with those little hands and say, "Ha, you attacked me," and then they can horribly beat up their victims. That's what the Zionists have done. They pose as victims when actually they are powerful oppressors. And the United States does the same thing. The United States, before each of its major wars, has set up or orchestrated a false flag attack to justify its war and to make the United States look like the victim. From the Mexican War, in which the U.S. invaded Mexico, started a shoot up, and then broadcast front page headlines saying Mexico attacks the United States, to the Remember the Maine incident, in which the United States agents blew up their own ship, the USS Maine, and blamed it on Cuba, to the Lusitania incident and the Zimmerman telegram that launched U.S. involvement in World War I, to the orchestrated Pearl Harbor deception, in which the U.S. used an eight-point plan to trick Japan or force Japan into attacking first and make them look like the aggressors in World War II, to the Gulf of Tonkin incident that brought the U.S. into Vietnam, making it look like the Vietnamese had attacked an American ship, to the mother of all false flags, the September 11th event, in which the U.S. and Israel together blew up the Trade Center, murdered 3,000 Americans in order to make it look like radical Muslims and Palestinians were the aggressors. They've been doing this forever. The bullies want their victims to look like aggressors, and they themselves, the bullies, want to look like victims. That's the game. That's the big lie that the Israelis and the U.S. are putting out, that more and more people are starting to see through it.
Well, Daniel Kovalik, you talked about the U.S. and the U.N., I believe, in your last statements in the beginning of that. Why is it that the U.S. has blocked three times now, and it appears that it's going to do it for the fourth time, the adoption of a joint U.S. Security Council statement which calls for a halt to Israeli-Palestinian or the onslaught of Israel's offensive on the Palestinian territories in the Gaza Strip in particular, and the protection of civilians?
Well, because the U.S. views Israel as its beachhead in the Middle East. The U.S. supports Israel because it sees it as the one country it can use to exert influence and to project power in the Middle East, and it will do anything to protect Israel's interests, even by supporting Israel's war crimes. And these are war crimes that are being committed in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, where there are pogroms now being committed against Palestinians with the assistance of Israeli security forces. But this is all according to plan. The plan is for Israel to take over all of Palestine and beyond, and the U.S. supports Israel's dream of a greater Israel within the Middle East. But this is not about religion. Truthfully, this is more about whiteness than it is religion. This is the U.S.'s ability to project white supremacy in the Middle East through Israel. And it is a disgrace, and it is heartbreaking.
Well, Kevin Barrett, there seems to be this other narrative, which many are saying, descriptions that involve things like a tectonic shift. This time it's different, as some are saying, about what has happened, especially since there is this momentum behind world condemnation. We see it in the protest that's happening in the masses. And many are saying that this is similar, very much like what happened to the apartheid regime in South Africa before it was abolished or before it ceased to exist. Do you see it that way?
Yes, I think that's a good comparison in many ways, actually. Both South Africa and occupied Palestine are settler colonial societies. That is, unlike normal colonialism, which was bad enough, where Britain, France, and other countries moved in and took over countries, stole their resources, exploited their people. The settler colonial societies, like South Africa, Rhodesia, French Algeria, and, of course, occupied Palestine, brought replacement settlers in and expelled the natives. And those societies tended to mistreat the native peoples even worse than the normal colonialists. So there is a very good comparison. And it seems that just as in right around the time that the world changed at the end of the Cold War, there was a mass awakening to the evil of apartheid South Africa. And I'm proud to say I participated in that to some extent. I was in college in the late 70s and the early 80s, and there were big marches and protests against apartheid at that time, and it succeeded in dismantling apartheid. And so today we're seeing a little bit of the same kind of shift here in the United States and across the Western world, and indeed all over the world. But of course, most of the world has supported Palestine, at least morally, forever, but the West hasn't, and the U.S. in particular has been brainwashed by the power of the Zionist lobby. Now, this is a debate show, so I could at least find one thing to disagree with the other guest, who I generally agree with, but I don't think he's correct in saying that the U.S. is supporting Israel because Israel is carrying out American imperial duties and so on and so forth. No, it's actually the other way around. The U.S. is paying tribute to Israel because Zionists dominate the United States, and Israel is a terrific impediment to U.S. imperial success. As Brzezinski accurately wrote, that having to support this state that is utterly loathed in the region has greatly complicated the American imperial project. So I think, in any case, however we want to analyze that, the fact is that the brutal crimes and the extreme racism and the apartheid and the ethnic cleansing and what Professor Francis Boyle has argued is an actual genocide in occupied Palestine, all of this is so morally offensive that just like with apartheid, decent people who open their eyes and see what's going on and see what their government is supporting are becoming increasingly outraged. And that includes decent American Jewish people who are starting to turn against the apartheid entity. So this is all to the good, and I think that Israel's epitaph is being written.
Well, let me address the same question to you, Daniel Kovalik. I mean, I know what you said about the states in terms of its support for Israel and all that. But, you know, we're looking at some Congress women, I should say, that have voiced their disagreements, AOC and also Rashida Tlaib, in which she gave that very touching speech there in Congress. We're looking at world condemnations. We're looking at things that, again, many are saying that this time around is different. Do you think that this is maybe going down the path where the U.S. is going to be maybe one of the sole supporters of Israel? And the whole world, and it's going to be too much, that it may overwhelm the U.S. in terms of how the worldwide condemnation will be in such huge numbers that then the U.S. has to rethink the way that it's supporting Israel, et cetera. Do you think that there's a possibility of that?
I certainly think there's a possibility of that. I think the reason is for the same reason that people erupted in anger over the George Floyd killing and similar killings in the U.S., and that's because of homemade videos on cell phones. You know, the U.S. media has been awful on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but now they have to acknowledge what's happening because people are putting up videos of children being killed, of children under rubble, of civilians in West Bank, in Jerusalem, being subjected to violence by Israeli settlers. This cannot be denied anymore. I do think this is shifting public opinion, there's no doubt. There is a hope, of course, that this will affect U.S. foreign policy, and I pray that it does. I think, though, we have to remember that apartheid in South Africa fell not only because of a shift in world opinion, but also by the outside intervention of the Cuban military with the backing of the Soviet Union, who defeated the South African military in Angola. I don't necessarily see that sort of thing happening here, but I do think that support for Israel in the U.S., the days of that are numbered.
Okay. Well, what has made a difference in some way is the fact that you have rockets in retaliation to the Israeli bombardment to land in Israel, and it has reached towns, including Tel Aviv, Kevin Barrett. Tell us what you think about that and whether that has made a difference, because the reason why I'm addressing this question this way is there's nothing else that has come to rescue not only the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, but also what occurred at the Al-Quds compound, which was the way that Israel brutalized the people who went, the Palestinians who went there, who wanted to pray. And, of course, that opens up one of the core issues that exist in this whole crisis or conflict between Israelis and the Palestinians.
Yes, that's a great point. And I would respond what the other guest was saying, in that I think there is actually a parallel between the way that the Cubans, the Soviets, and the guerrillas in southern Africa were a major factor in defeating apartheid, and the way the axis of resistance and the rockets available now to Hamas and especially Hezbollah have changed the strategic equation in the region, in the same way that the Cuban and Soviet interventions changed the strategic equation in southern Africa in preceding the demise of apartheid. I think there is actually a comparison there, because the fact is that the Israelis have been unable to defeat their opponents in recent conflicts. They define defeating their opponents as forcing them to stop firing rockets, and they can't do it. They couldn't defeat Hezbollah in 2006. They haven't been able to defeat Hamas, and they still won't be able to now. And as Hezbollah and Hamas amass bigger and better rockets, and as the Muslim world unites, and some Christians are even waking up and noticing that the Zionist project is horrifically blasphemous and obscene in terms of occupying the Christian and Muslim holy land, the land that's holy in part because the Messiah, the man that both the Christians and Muslims agree is the Messiah, came from that land. And this movement made up of people who despise that Messiah and who have despised God as well, they're mostly atheists now, have taken over this holy land and just rubbed the noses of God-fearing people in the dirt, and had this supremacist project going. This is starting to bring out a religious dimension of this conflict that wasn't there in southern in Africa, and that's a lot of the force. You see, Hamas and Hezbollah are religiously motivated, and that gives them an edge. It makes it harder for them to be infiltrated, and it gives them essentially a metaphysical reason to be willing to die for a good and noble and just and righteous and holy cause. So I think that dimension of the conflict, along with that military equation shifting to favor the axis of resistance, is an important factor that will lead to the demise of apartheid in the Zionist entity in a way that's somewhat parallel to what happened in southern Africa a couple of decades ago.
Final question to you, Daniel Kobalik. We have the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. It has been going on for years now, and it has come out urging renewed economic pressure on Israel. Military embargo, boycott of firms that are complicit in Israeli occupation, and it also said the canceling of academic, cultural, and sporting events in addition to that. It sounds great, and it has done what it could, but what about it now, making this call, especially countries who want to adopt a resolution or a statement that can't because of the U.S. at the U.N. Why don't they put their money where their mouth is and come on board with the BDS request?
Well, I think you will see more and more people and more countries get on board. Again, we do see, again, the comparison to South African apartheid, where you had the disinvestment and divestment movements. I was also part of that in college. And obviously, the BDS movement is taking a page out of that playbook by what it's doing. And I think it is effective, not just economically, but it is an embarrassment to Israel. The entertainers won't go there and perform like they wouldn't go to Sun City and perform. You even have Jewish actors coming out against Israel and saying they won't perform there. And so I think this is putting a huge amount of pressure on Israel, and they are going to come out of this conflict right now with a huge black eye, and they will never be seen the same.
Thank you for that. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Daniel Kovalik there, human rights and labor lawyer. Thank you. And also Kevin Barrett, author, Middle East expert. Thank you for your statements. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikova Tapwa, the entire team in the capital of Tehran, is goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A self-powered robot inspired by a fish can survive the extreme pressures at the bottom of the ocean's deepest trench thanks to its soft body and distributed electronic system, and might enable exploration of the uncharted ocean. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Cecilia Laschi-Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Soft Robot Reaches the Deepest Part of the Ocean. Stay tuned for more. Riding in nature, Li et al. Report a robot made from soft materials that can brave the unexplored depths of the sea. Remarkably, the authors demonstrate that the robot can operate in the Mariana Trench, the deepest part of the ocean. Conventional underwater vehicles require watertight enclosures made of metallic materials to withstand the high pressures of the deep ocean. The thickness and dimensions of these enclosures have to be increased to cope with greater depth. But in Lee and colleagues' robot, the delicate electronic components are embedded and distributed in soft silicon, a design that removes the need for pressure-resistant cases. Largely inspired by living organisms, the field of soft robotics involves making robots from pliable materials. Polymers such as silicon are often used, as well as highly deformable structures such as braids and textiles. Soft robots are intrinsically safer than their conventional rigid counterparts in interactions with humans, and their pliability can boost many capabilities, such as their dexterity when manipulating objectives, and their ability to squeeze into tight spaces or to travel across uneven surfaces. Marine species such as squid and octopus were one of the original inspirations for soft robotics research. But soft robotics in turn offers a new approach for tackling marine applications of robots. Lee and colleagues' work is a powerful demonstration of this. The author's robot is designed to have a fish-like body shape and two flapping side fins. The authors used a well-established mechanism to drive flapping. The fins are attached to muscles on the robot's body. These are made of a soft material that converts electrical energy into mechanical work. When an electric current from the robot's battery is applied to the muscles, they contract. Tiny solid structures mechanically connect the contracting muscles to the fins, making them flap. One of the challenges faced by Lee and co-workers was finding a way to protect the robot's electronic components from high pressures. Taking inspiration from the bones in the skull of the Haddell snailfish, the authors spaced the electronic components apart rather than packing them together as is typically done in electronic devices. Laboratory tests and simulations demonstrated that this arrangement reduces the stress at the interfaces between components under pressure. The distributed electronics were then embedded in silicon for incorporation into the robot. This approach is more practical and cheaper than other methods for protecting electronics in deep-sea devices. Lee et al. First tested the swimming ability of the robot in the lab, in a pressurized water chamber. The robot was connected to a pole, which it swam around in a circle. The machine was then tested in a lake at a depth of 70 meters, where it swam freely at a speed of 3.16 centimeters per second. And then in South China Sea at a depth of about 3,200 meters. It reached a speed of 5.19 centimeters, equivalent to 45/10th body length per second, which is in line with the capabilities of other soft robots. Finally, the flapping movement and pressure resistance of the robot were tested in the Mariana Trench, where it was connected to a conventional underwater robot for support, which also took images of the test. So, Several previous attempts have been made to develop soft robots for applications underwater, a realm in which it is challenging for robots to interact delicately with objects because robotic sensors don't work well in this environment. Soft robotic grippers offer substantial advantages over rigid grasping devices when collecting and handling delicate sea organisms for study by marine biologists. And bio-inspired soft robotic fishes can swim among other animals without distressing them, thereby allowing close-up study. Lee and co-workers' research now pushes the boundaries of what can be achieved. The replacement of rigid protective enclosures for electronic components by distributed electronics embedded in a soft material paves the way for a new generation of deep-sea explorers. There is, however, more work to do before the ocean can be populated with robots of this type of design. Lee and co-workers' machine is a slower than previously reported underwater robots and cannot withstand sizable disturbances. It could easily be swept away by underwater currents. Its locomotor capabilities will also need to be optimized for practical applications. However, Lee and colleagues' approach lays the foundations for future generations of resilient and reliable deep-sea explorers. In the long term, one can predict avenues of research being opened up for marine biology, in which soft robots safely navigate coral reefs or underwater caves to collect delicate specimens without damaging them. Swarms of underwater soft robots with the ability to crawl on the seabed, anchor themselves on to specific structures, or swim over particular areas could contribute to the development of technologies for various other applications. These might include monitoring the ocean, cleaning up, and preventing sea pollution, or preventing marine biodiversity. More fundamentally, they could help researchers to explore the vast uncharted depth of the oceans.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.